Fritz shrugged. What do you mean, not happening? We're on demand as it is. Billy reached into the bag of clothes lying on an unoccupied desk, pulled out the pair of girls' corduroy pants and held it in his fist. Let me tell you what that guy did. He sat on his ass until he saw your donut eaters roll by, knew he had a good 55 minutes, ate a sandwich, did the crossword, bloodied up my porch, took a piss, washed his car and went home. I want, my family needs, a 24-hour fixed post. Donut eaters? Billy took a breath. Look, I'm sorry about that. I swear to you, I'm not one of those NYPD assholes who thinks every cop outside the five boroughs is some Ibajiba related by blood to Barney Fife. Without excusing himself, Lefkowitz stepped off to talk to another detective about a different issue, Billy taking it to mean that maybe his Mayberry riff had been a little too lovingly delivered. Hey, this is my town too, he said when Lefkowitz returned. I'm living my life here. Raising my kids here, paying my taxes, and all I'm asking you for is just a little bit more protection. Like I said, we're on demand as it is. All due respect, but could I speak to your boss? She'll just tell you the same. Nonetheless, fine by me, Lefkowitz said, walking away. She'll be in next week. As Billy came up on Brown's family funeral home that night, Redmond, wearing a full-body apron and latex gloves, was standing in the narrow doorway swapping cash for Chinese takeout with a delivery boy. You mean to tell me you're okay walking the streets like that? Redmond said without raising his eyes from the exchange. Like what? Don't you have a mirror at home? Redmond counted out his change. Come in here. Once they were inside the chapel, Redmond had Billy take off his shirt and lie down on a somewhat clean gurney. Then, reaching into his cluttered cosmetics cart, he found a jar of standard Caucasian camouflage cream and went to work on the constellation of bruises that, between Pavlicek and Carmen, had erupted across Billy's face since the morning. You ever notice how the storefronts line up in this neighborhood? Redmond said. Dunkin' Donuts, Popeyes, Roy Rogers, Ashley Stewart's Big Women's Shop. Then a funeral parlor, all cheek to cheek like a de-evolution cartoon. They have fat people in Nebraska, too, last I heard, Billy said, wondering when they were going to get to Pavlicek. My point being, Redmond stepping back to assess his work, then peeling off his gloves, I had two bodies coming in this week, a 500-pounder and a 4. But when I added the weight of the casket, I realized that my front steps would collapse. So I had to farm them out to Carolina Home up the block because the director over there was smart enough to put in reinforced steel. Rafer came rolling into the room, made two quick circuits around his father, then charged at an old man sporting a Masonic fez and apron, who was lying in his casket parked by the piano. So, Billy sat up and reached for his shirt. Why am I here? Redmond took a limping stroll around the chapel, straightened out a few folding chairs, then slowly came back. Look, I'm gonna save you a lot of trouble. How's that? Billy said, feeling the cadaver cream starting to grip. It's done. What is? All what you've been looking into. Billy was quiet, waiting for more. Then, how am I supposed to let him get away with this? Who, the lone gunman? What? You think we all sent Pavlicek out there like that? What then? All of us. Billy swiped at his caked jaw with a shaking hand. Who's all of us? Pavlicek didn't do anything more than his part. All of us. Including you? Why not me? Look at you, Billy said cruelly. And then he was aloft, Redmond holding him 2 feet off the ground with those harpooner's arms, the guy wheeling so fast on his cracked hips that Billy hadn't even felt the long fingers slip under his arms. Why not me? Redmond holding him up in the air like a baby. Put me down, please. Redmond deposited him in a folding chair, Rafer immediately raising his arms to his father. My turn. You did, sweet pea, Billy said. Bullshit. The wit said the doer had straight hair, nothing about a fucking afro. Redman picked up his son, held him in one arm. That wit was 6 floors up and off his ass high. You said so yourself. Billy grabbed a rag and swiped at his face, but the makeup had turned to cement. His girlfriend said she heard a white voice over the cell. Do I ever sound like some mushmouth street nigger to you?
You kind of did right there, Billy said.
Rafer started to wail.
What you crying for, man?
Redman hitch-limped over to the Samsung and found something on the Cartoon Network. Billy went momentarily south, checking his watch, 10 p.m., wondering if this kid even had a bedtime.
Why? He said.
Because it felt right. It felt fair.
Why?
Pavlicek's boy. We all known him since he was wearing a diaper. First of the kids born to us.
Redman.
It's not like playing God, because me personally, to tell you the truth, the only time I believe in God is when something shitty happens. Like little man here in his G-tube, or John Jr. catching leukemia. I'm in here sending people off 3-4 times a week to meet Jesus or whoever, but you know what I believe in? Earth. Dirt. This right here, all the rest is a story. I guess I'm in the wrong business.
So everybody was in on it.
Billy went away again, telling himself that there had always been something off about Redman. Look how he chose to make a living. Look how many wives he'd had. Look how many kids.
Billy, we all saved each other's lives one time or another, including me, yours.
And to let the kid play around dead bodies all day, Redman and his wife. What was the child-rearing philosophy here?
Billy,
Redman bringing him back,
I am telling you all this because it's over.
He held his long basketball hands in front of his belt, gently tamping down the air like shushing a baby.
So let it be.
Billy made it back home by midnight, but unwilling to go in and risk a conversation with Carmen tonight, he parked halfway down the street, intending to sit tight until the bedroom window went dark. An hour into the wait, he reached for his notebook and made out the chart. Redman, Sweet Pea. Yasmin, Cortez. Pavlicek, Banyan. Tomasi's death by bus kept Whelan's name off the chart, and Curtis Taft didn't make it either, though Pavlicek had served him up to Billy, hoping he would complete the sweep. But as he continued to sit there and study the neat matchups, he began to wonder if Redman, in order to protect Pavlicek, had been selling him a story back at the chapel, thinking that if Billy bought the conspiracy angle and thought he'd have to bring down 3 friends instead of just one, he might lose heart and walk away. The 24/7 directed patrol unit cruised past his car without noticing him in the driver's seat, slowed down in front of the house, but never came to a stop in order to allow the cops to get out and inspect the grounds. It was the 3rd pass he had observed since parking here, each more lax than the one before. As he reached for his cigarettes on the dash, the pack slipped through his fingers and landed between his feet. When he bent over to retrieve them, his forehead touched the steering wheel, and that was that. Billy sitting up an hour later with a pink streak above his eyes as vivid as a brand. He checked the time. 2 a.m. The bedroom window was dark. Stepping from the car, he discovered that the asphalt beneath his feet was dappled with dried paint, the leakage from the clothes bag before it had been thrown onto his porch. Whoever had done the deed last night had chosen the same observation point as he had, a spot far enough away to avoid detection, but near enough to track the life of the house. Using the maglite he kept in his glove compartment, Billy tracked the drippings from his car toward his house, until they came to a stop 30 yards out from the porch. Here, the spatter took on a roughly circular pattern, the elongated drops at the outer edges suggesting that the actor, having picked this place for a launching pad, had then gone into a hammer-throw spin to build up enough centrifugal force to hit his mark 90 feet away. Billy sat in his father's rocker on the porch, imagining their stalker, their fury, whipping that goddamn bag around and around himself before letting it fly, just sat there running and rerunning the film until he found himself suddenly flooded by a powerful halo of light. The search beam of the directed patrol car coming by for its 3:30 a.m. look-see. When Billy raised his hand, they cut the beam and slowly rolled off, but not before the driver called out, "Here, I'm full," and then tossed something onto the lawn. Once the car was out of sight, he walked through the damp grass and found a crumpled paper bag, inside of which was a half-eaten donut. When he finally entered the sleeping house, the silence was so absolute that it created its own sound, a high, even hiss like static from a distant source. Walking into the kitchen, Billy decided, once he opened the freezer, that he didn't need a drink tonight. Well, maybe just a pull. Wiping his lips afterward, then heading for the stairs. Soft stepping into the bedroom, he jumped when he saw Carmen in silhouette sitting on a chair beneath the window, her hands flat on her thighs. "What are you doing?" he whispered. "What's wrong?"
"I saw him," she said.
"Saw who?" Then, "You saw him? Where?"
"In a dream."
Milton Ramos. The evening had started out okay enough. Anita and Ray bringing Sophia and a little friend to meet him at a diner in Staten Island so that he could hand over his care package of new clothes, DVDs, and favorite animals. His daughter seemed excited to see him, crawling into his lap to eat her low-fat mock sundae. But the whole time he feared that at the end of the meal she wouldn't ask him to take her home. Not that he would have done it. At first, Sophia's new friend had thrown him. The kid, Jen, or Jan, a scrawny little thing with no more personality than a hamster, lived two houses down the street from Anita, and the girls, once introduced, had apparently become instant blood sisters and were, in fact, having a sleepover tonight. Sophia had never had a sleepover in her life, let alone a best friend. Their caged house in the Bronx had never been a home to other kids, even for a few hours after school, and this realization made him wince. When the bill came, Ray nearly snatched it out of the waitress's hand. "No arguments," he said. "Fine with me," Milton said. Sophia slid off his lap and moved to the other side of the table.
"When we go home," she said to Anita, "can we call Marilise?"
Then to her mouse of a friend,
"She's my other mom."
"I know,"
Jan or Jen said with delighted exasperation.
"You tell me all the time."
It was the third time Sophia had brought up Marilise since the waitress had taken their orders, and it would be the last.
"Listen to me,"
Milton said, his sleeve sliding through the dregs of his dessert as he reached across and took her wrist.
"Marilise isn't your other mom. Marilise isn't anything. She doesn't love you. She doesn't even care about you, okay?"
"Hey, Milton," Ray said. "Can you get that through your head?" Sophia was too shocked to do anything other than stare at him in red-faced astonishment. But the other kid, after a breathless second, started to cry as if the world had come to an end. Mortified, he got up from the table, walked out the door, and marched into the diner's parking lot. Weaving his way through an army of parked cars to an unlit spot, he seethed in the dark for a few minutes, then pulled out his phone and called Marilise's sister.
"This is Milton Ramos. You remember me?"
She said she did, but she didn't sound too happy about it.
"I'm going to call you back in a half hour. When I do, you're going to give me the names, addresses, and phone numbers of everybody in your family living in New York."
Milton stepped deeper into the shadows as Ray came out of the diner, and a moment later pulled out of the lot with a carload of mutes.
"If I call back and for any reason you don't pick up, I'm coming back to your house. Do yourself a big favor and save me the trip."
At 11 that evening, he sat across the oilcloth-covered dinette table, glaring at Marilise and her so-called cousin Ottavio, a balding runt with amphibious eyes. They were in Ottavio's one-bedroom apartment in Astoria, Milton's former fiancé and her kinsman anxiously looking everywhere but at him.
"They were going to kill him,"
Marilise said numbly, staring first at Milton's hands with their paint-rimmed nails the color of blood,
then at the greasy bat he had placed between them on the table. "Who's they?" he said. Then, "You!" making Ottavio jump. "Who's they?"
"Some individuals I got steered to wrong."
"They were going to kill him,"
Marilise repeated, forcing herself to meet his eye. He didn't know what angered him more, the fact that she had so heartlessly ravaged his life for money and dismissed his daughter's need for her like it was nothing, or the fact that, despite his desire to slaughter her, she was treating him like a total stranger. "You're living here now?"
"Just for a little bit."
Her voice down to a hush. "You really her cousin?"
"Distant," Ottavio said, unconsciously glancing toward the sole bedroom.
"I want my money back," he said.
"It's gone,"
Marilise said, once again staring at his bunched hands. Milton went off into his boiling head long enough for Marilise to add,
"We can start paying you back a little each week."
"We." And the thought of having to see her or him every week or month to maybe collect $20 here, $30 there, the excuses, the no-shows, the constant snake-headed presence of them in his life. "I don't want your fucking money." He took up his bat and slowly got to his feet, Marilise raising her eyes and then asking in a breathless monotone,
"What are you going to do?"
"Nothing." Whether it was some perverse residual feelings he still had for her, or just a failure of nerve on his part, he would do nothing. He reached for his coat. When it became apparent that she was in no physical danger this night, she added more softly,
"Milton, I made a mistake. I'm sorry."
And then a PPS as he turned toward the door.
"How's Sophia?"
When Victor Acosta finally left the Bryant Motor Lodge at 4 o'clock in the morning, there was a three-woman, two-man smackdown going on in a corner of the parking lot, and Milton, who had already been waiting on him for 2 hours, maybe longer, understood that he had no choice right now but to remain in his car, which he figured was probably just as well, since he'd been hitting the thermos steady and was temporarily too drunk to not fuck this up. While Victor was busy stowing his gear in the Range Rover, Milton, in hopes of sobering up, put all four windows down and the AC on full blast, and then rolled out of the lot directly onto the southbound New England Thruway, driving from the Bronx to Queens to Brooklyn. 35 minutes later, freezing but still wasted, he pulled up across the street from Victor's apartment building on Palmetto Street in Bushwick and settled in, taking one last nip of the truce to chase the chill. He didn't have to wait long, Victor's Range Rover slow cruising right past him while he was still feeling around the floor after dropping the thermos cap. At first, it looked almost too easy. Victor parking the Ranger one block ahead, then walking back in his direction. But when Milton stepped from the car, he immediately fell back against the driver's door, weakly waved his bat at the sky, then hinged forward to puke into the roadway as Victor, wide-berthing the mess, made it to his front door unmolested and disappeared into the building. Just as well. Just as well. When his vomiting came down to a few ropey strands of saliva and his eyes began to lose their strained filminess, he slowly raised himself up and took a few raw breaths. Just as well. Then, unbidden, "I don't want your fucking money." Why did he say that to her? It was his fucking money. She might have scammed him out of it, but he had said, "Your money," as if she had taken his sense of self along with the cash, had date-raped his brain, and he had just walked out the door, don't mind the wet spot. He slammed the bat into his own car door, was about to do it again, do anything to fend off his other memory of tonight. Sophia's shell-shocked silence, her stunned poke-hole of a face, when the magnified clack of a turned latch abruptly brought him back, Milton looking up to see Victor returning to the street with a small dog. It was like he was asking for it, like he was insisting on it. The dog, some kind of small pug,
immediately squatted and pissed on the pavement, the streetlight too bright right there to risk anything. But when Victor turned the corner, Milton, keeping his distance and sticking tight to the shadowed building fronts, followed. They walked in a two-man stagger nearly the length of the street before Victor, absorbed in his dog's doings, came to a complete stop with his back to him. The distance between them was next to nothing, but he was still too wasted to close in fast, and the broadcasted wheeze of his lungs, the sloppy scrape of his bat against the pavement had Victor fully turned around and reaching for something on his belt before Milton could make contact. And then came the invisible jolt to his torso, a white wallop of phosphorescent pain emanating from somewhere between his left hip and armpit that lifted him like a backhand into the side of a building. But he was too drunk and too determined to let it distract him for long, and after shutting down what needed to be shut down, Milton once again began to close in. The dazzling burn in his side made it difficult for him to really bring the bat around like he wanted, and the lead pipe impact of the heavy-booted sidekick that Victor delivered to his thigh at some point didn't help. But when he was done, Carmen's brother lay curled at his feet, blood bubbling from his nostrils each time he took a breath, an ivory shard of bone that had broken through the sleeve of his shirt, winking in the moonlight. By the time Milton managed to circle around and slowly drive past the scene, a small crowd had already formed. Dope fiends, joggers, dog walkers, and what have you, everyone on their cells either calling out or making iPhone videos, the flashers of an approaching ambo lighting up the street like a midway. From the car, he spotted his bloodied bat lying up against the curb, but there was nothing he could do about that now. It wasn't until an hour later, while standing outside the cage gate of his house and woozily patting himself down for the keys, that he finally noticed the dual taser darts still buried between his ribs, their attached wires dangling down his side like extruded nerves. Chapter 15. There were six people in the visitor's waiting room outside the OR of the Maimonides Medical Center. Billy, Carmen, Bobby Cordozo, a detective from the 80 squad, and three of Victor and Richard's friends. Gym rats, by the look of them, everyone waiting for Victor to come out from under the knife. The damage, a shattered left humerus, a fractured right collarbone, the left lung pierced by the lowest and smallest of his three broken ribs, was gruesome, the only good news being that the actor had stayed away from his head. "Bobby, can you get Prince off the bat?" Billy asked Cardozo, whose black eyes, goatee, and kettle drum gut made him look like a villain in a silent movie.
"We're sending it to the lab this afternoon, so hopefully."
Richard Cuban came into the waiting room with a vending machine coffee, his anger making him look broader and taller than Billy had ever seen him.
"Your friend," Cardozo began.
"My husband."
"He carried a taser?"
"You would too if you saw where he worked."
"I'm just asking."
"Look, we know who did this,"
a short red-bearded weightlifter said.
They didn't, but Billy did, as did Carmen, who, rather than browbeating Cardozo and the entire hospital staff, was sitting silently on a tatty couch, staring at her hands. "These little mutants from the Knickerbockers," the bearded guy said, "they sport hunt us like we're their personal buffalo herd."
"What are you talking, gay bashes?" Cardozo reared back. "You sure? I pass your friend Mr. Acosta on the street, I'm not thinking gay."
"Meaning what?" Richard snapped.
"I'm just saying," Cardozo retreated.
"Saying what?"
Cardozo threw Billy a quick, helpless look, then stepped away to regroup. At first, Billy didn't understand why he was refraining from volunteering information about the stalker in order to help refocus the investigation. And then he did. Simply put, he felt ashamed. As far as he knew, they had all been victimized, but somehow over the course of the last few weeks, the innocence of the people living under his roof had gradually come to feel tainted, as if they all in some way deserved what had been happening to them. It was a classic reaction, he knew, the victim falling into self-loathing and self-blame, but now that the family contagion had reached out and claimed Victor,
He felt as guilty as if he had swung the bat himself. And Carmen, sitting there so uncharacteristically withdrawn, had to be feeling something of the same.
"These kids," Cardozo said, taking out his notepad.
"Kids?"
"These individuals. Any names, street tags?"
"There's two," said another friend, wearing a Bucknell t-shirt. "I know them by sight."
"And the other one," the weightlifter said. "The moron with the hat."
"How about this?" Cardozo said, stowing his pad. "Why don't you all come in? We'll set you up with some photo trays. Then we can do a ride-by around the Knickerbockers, see if you can maybe make some IDs that way."
"You know what?" Bucknell said. "Forget it. We'll take care of it ourselves."
"How about you don't?" Billy volunteered.
"Do you know how many assault complaints we filed with your precinct this year?"
Bucknell wheeling on Billy.
"Do you know how many times I've been in that building? You people just don't give a shit."
"First I'm hearing about it," Cardozo said.
"Exactly."
Billy looked to Richard, hoping that he could help cool out his friends, and saw that the anger in his eyes was beginning to give way to exhaustion and sorrow. Reaching through the scrum, Billy took his arm and steered him to a second couch directly opposite his wife.
"He'll be all right," Billy said.
"How do you know?"
"You know how I know? I'll tell you how I know." Billy hesitated, then. "The nurses' station. If Victor was in any kind of touch-and-go situation, all those nurses over there, they'd have been throwing our crowd a lot of looks by now, trying to figure out how to handle us in case things turn out bad. And I'm just not picking up that vibe from them, so relax." It was total bullshit, but it seemed to do the job. Richard faintly nodding, then sliding back deeper into the cushions. Nurses. Billy stole another peek at his wife, not 6 feet away from them, but still so pulled into herself that he doubted she had heard one word of his nonsense.
"So when are the twins coming?" he asked Richard.
"What?
When are..."
10 days,
he said, then sitting up.
"Jesus."
"I'll come over,"
Carmen said dully. Raising her eyes to him, she added,
"Every day."
Leaving his wife and Richard behind, Billy went along with everyone else to the 8-0. Once there, unable to bear withholding information about the family nightmare any longer, he took Bobby Cardozo aside.
"I need to talk to you about something."
"About what, the gay thing?"
Cardozo whispered.
"I said the guy didn't look gay. What the fuck, it was a compliment."
Billy's cell rang. Carmen. Billy stepping away from Cardozo to take the call.
"Hey."
Her voice is flatlined as it was when he left her. "What's going on?"
"He's out of surgery. It went okay."
"Good, excellent."
"I'm sleeping here tonight," she said.
"Okay."
"I need you to do me a favor. When you get home, make up a bag with some clothes and my meds. You know which ones?"
"The Traz and the Cymbalta."
"The Traz and the Abilify."
"When did you go on Abilify?"
"Can you just do it for me? Give it to Millie, let her take your car, punch in the address on the GPS for her and send her over."
"All right, I'll be home in about 2 hours.
"Thank you."
"Carmen, what's wrong?"
"What's wrong?"
"I mean, besides, you've been in a trance for days." The silence on the other end was so absolute that Billy thought she had hung up on him. "Hello?"
"Just not now, okay?"
she said. Then added,
"I'm sorry,"
sounding like she meant it. Billy found Cardozo pulling up mugshots on a desk monitor.
"This kid here?"
he said, tapping a shave-headed teenager with a wandering eye. "He's a stone skullcracker. Pipes, rebar, golf club one time. Told me that he didn't like guns because they could get you in trouble." "Just hold off on that for a bit," Billy said, pulling up a chair. "You need to hear this." It took close to half an hour for him to lay it all out. The accosting of his son, the abduction of his father, the red assault on his porch, the entire systematic and now expanded tormenting of his family.
"I don't see it," Cardozo said. "With all the three-legged meat-eaters we got running around this precinct, I'm shopping local."
Yasmin rang him at home as he was sorting through Carmen's side of the medicine chest.
"You called me yesterday?" she said.
"I did?" Then remembering the world as it was before this morning. "Yeah, I did."
"What's going on?"
"I need to talk to you."
"Again?"
"Just,
Jesus, I talk to you more than my husband. What are you trying to do, get back with me?
Right. Just say, we'll get a room. Cut it out. With how stressed I am? No shit, let's go.
I seriously need to talk to you.
You don't even have to kiss me.
Where are you going to be today? Billy said. I'll come to you.
Redman's nuts. I shot Eric Cortez? Are you on drugs?
They were sitting on a bench overlooking the playground in Riverdale where Yasmin's younger daughter Simone was trying to master double dutch with some other girls.
You know what? I don't like to talk about people, but since he's already talking about me, I think Redman's smoking his own product.
What product? Billy shielding his eyes from the unfamiliar midday sun.
Embalming fluid. Dipping his cigarettes in that shit? It's like eating your brain with an ice cream scoop.
Redman doesn't smoke.
Then maybe you're doing dip. What the fuck? I shot Eric Cortez?
Billy sat with his arms draped along the top slat of the bench, listening to the kids behind the mesh fence shrieking as if they were about to be butchered.
You're drinking like you want to kill yourself, Yasmin. Why is that?
Because I already said to you I'm going through life changes and I'm depressed. I confessed to you about that. I confided in you about that. And now you're going to use it to accuse me of some bullshit like this? Who do you think you are?
Billy slumped forward on the bench, his head in his hands.
Tell me again about your night sweats. How you wake up thinking you're all bloody. How someone's going to hurt your kids. His voice monotone with gloom.
Yasmin sat there for a moment, her lower face flexing and bulging as if her mouth was stuffed with marbles.
I tell you what, she said, getting to her feet. Here's what you do. You go to your good buddy in Brooklyn Narcotics and share your findings with him. You tell him all about me fucking up the Delpino investigation. You tell him all about my nightmares and my drinking. You tell him how Cortez being brain shot just about makes me wet, and then you let him come for me. How's that?
Yasmin went to the fence, collected her protesting daughter, then walked past him on her way out of the park.
You're like some stranger to me, you know that?
And then she was gone. Billy sitting there, thinking, so are you all. After a busted 4-hour sleep and a tasteless dinner, Billy found himself watching a football game on NFL Classics, his sons in full Pee-wee League gear, cleats to helmets, seated on either side of him. They were all strung out, Billy over everything, and the kids just because they had, no, they were, exquisite antennae when it came to in-house agitation. The game from 2012 was a great New York Giants come-from-behind victory, 41-34 over Tampa Bay. But when watching these old games, Billy never told his boys the final score in advance. It would be like telling a joke punchline first. Tonight, unfortunately, that meant subjecting them to 3 Eli Manning second-quarter interceptions with no hope in sight. By the second pick, Carlos began to cry, which got Declan, also on the verge of tears, throwing a punch and hurting his hand on his younger brother's helmet. And before Billy could intervene, they were both wailing like paid mourners while blindly trading shots across the bow of his gut.
"What are you hitting him for?" he squawked at Declan. Then turning to Carlos, "What you crying for?"
Neither kid had the words or the self-control to stop belting the other, which resulted in him pushing them off to the far sides of the couch.
"Everybody stop hitting and crying, all right? Just please, okay?"
Pausing the game, he waited for them to subside. He knew he should turn the TV off altogether before the third interception sent them completely over the edge, but he also wanted them to hang in there so that they could experience the thrill of the fourth quarter comeback, so they all could. "You guys want to keep watching, or do you want to go play?"
"Watch," Declan wept. "Watch,"
Carlos said, aping his brother's tragic delivery.
"You sure?"
"Yes."
"You have that new game upstairs you could play."
"Watch,"
Dex said in a shuddery hush.
"Watch."
"Okay, watch," reaching for the remote. Then, "You know what, let's see it tomorrow instead." No one protested. Tomorrow will be better. And it would be, Billy intending to fast-forward the DVR'd version directly to the fourth quarter for them. All joy and no pain. John McCormick called an hour later as Billy was coming out of the kids' bedroom after having told them their favorite story about the time when, as a rookie, he had chased down and subdued a riderless police horse in Times Square, leaving out, as he always did, the most heroic part of the adventure, the fact that he was off his ass drunk at the time. Otherwise, he'd have never been so idiotic as to bolt from his window seat at the bar and start running like a maniac down Broadway.
"Just thought you might want to know," McCormick said. "Eric Cortez went out of the picture."
"What happened?"
"Pulmonary infection. The fucking guy survives being left outdoors overnight, brain shot in January weather, then goes and gets pneumonia in a warm hospital 3 months later."
"So now it's a homicide?"
"So now it's a homicide," McCormick said. "Just grabbing at straws here. You sure you don't have anything for me?"
"Wish I did," Billy said, surprised by a surge of protectiveness toward Yasmin.
"All right, then.
Let me ask you, what day was he found?"
"Cortez? The 5th. Why?"
"January 5th?
"Yeah, why?"
"No reason," Billy said. "Thanks for the update." As soon as he got off the phone with McCormick, he began putting a call through to Yasmin, then hung up and called her husband instead, Dennis blowing up at him halfway through, "Hello."
"What the hell did you say to her today? She came home half out of her mind."
"What did she say?" I said.
"She didn't, but what the fuck, Billy? She's just starting to do good again."
"It was nothing, just some bullshit I was thinking I wanted to talk to somebody about, but I shouldn't have picked her. Can you apologize for me?"
"Apologize yourself."
"No, you're right. I'll call her. Everything okay otherwise?"
"Same old."
Dennis sounding calmer.
"So the reason I called you, she said you took your family to Florida?"
"Yeah, Boynton Beach to spend New Year's with my parents. And people say I don't know how to party. Can you imagine that?"
"I hear you. How long were you down there?"
"From like the 30th to the 8th. Why?"
"I was thinking of taking the kids. They'd never been."
The 30th to the 8th. Billy thinking. Good news for her. Thinking. Fucking Redman. And back to thinking. All Pavlicek. All the time.
He had the option of taking the night off, but he didn't want to be alone. Didn't want to think about Pavlicek, Victor, the stalker, his father, or even his wife. And so with Millie sleeping over and the slapdash 24/7 patrols at least going through the motions, he drove into the city at midnight, hoping for a change that the general malice out there would keep him busy until the morning. But in the way of these things, the night, as of 3 a.m, was another dud. A home invasion on West 46th Street in which the home invader got his ass beat by the homeowner, and a brawl at Complications, a pole dance club on the West Side Highway where a few visiting Memphis Grizzlies had been throwing back Dom and stuffing hundreds, although none of them were involved in the fight. The wheel called as he was driving back across 23rd Street to the office.
"We got a stabbing homicide in the 3-5.
"Indoors or out?"
"In, Fort Washington and 191st.
"Fort Washington and 191st?
Billy straightened up.
"What address?"
"I just said."
"The building number, for Christ's sake." By the time he showed up at Esteban Appleyard's apartment, it was a party. CSU, patrol, Stupak, Butter, and Jimmy Whelan himself, his retired gold shield hanging by a bead chain over a pullover sweatshirt. Jimmy had no business being there, but Billy wasn't going to say anything, and the others bought his expired tin at first sight even though he was wearing flip-flops. The small dining table in the living room was a tabloid tableau, two abandoned hands of cards, a knocked-over bottle of tattoo-spiced rum, three used glasses and an ashtray bearing the remains of 5 cool filter tips and a hollowed-out cigar wrapper that still held shreds of skunk. The body, belly down on the carpet in a pool of not-quite-dried blood, was crammed into a corner of the room as if Appleyard had tried to escape his killers by crawling through the wall. There were multiple stab wounds to his back and buttocks. Rigor had locked his mouth into a savagely wide grin. As the two CSU techs turned him over, they all saw that he was still holding his last hand, 5 cards clutched tight in a frozen grip beneath his chin.
"What's he got?" Billy asked.
One of the techs carefully prized the arm away from the body.
"Aces and 8s, just like Wild Bill."
bullshit, Whelan said. Take a look.
Whelan stooped over the body and squinted at the hand.
A pair of threes, he announced. You assholes.
Dead man's hand, baby, the tech laughed.
Who's Wild Bill?
Stupak said. Moments later, as the tech started to inventory the frontal devastation, a small, intact balloon of intestine began to peep shyly out of a puncture wound above Appleyard's navel, then slowly began to expand, those in the know quickly covering their noses and mouths before it could burst. Wanting to avoid the explosion of stench, Billy retreated into the bedroom, which, like the rest of the small four-room apartment, had been utterly ransacked. Plants torn out of their pots, underwear, shirts, and sweaters hanging from open dresser drawers, along with VHS porn tapes and an upended shoebox that had been filled with small, serrated-edge snapshots from Appleyard's childhood in Puerto Rico. Whelan wandered in and picked up a ripped-out peace lily, the soil that was still clinging to its roots drizzling onto the unmade bed.
How much money you think he could have hidden this pot? $13?
You sure this was about the lottery? Billy asked.
Of course it was, fucking guy. I told him 1,000 times, you heard me yourself.
Whelan picked up one of the old photos fantailed around the shoebox, a black and white of the victim as a little kid, standing with his mother by a seawall.
I swear, when God said he was passing out brains, Appleyard heard trains, didn't want any, and hid under a table.
Any thoughts on the actors?
Yeah, Whelan said, but not here.
When they left the apartment, the hallway was filled with tenants.
He's dead?
A neighbor asked Whelan.
You bet.
See, I told him,
another one said. Whelan clapped his hands once.
Everybody, just go back home.
This is my home.
Inside. You're not the boss of me. Got February's rent together yet, Alvin? How about March?
Jimmy, you disrespect me like that.
Whoever owes me 2 months' rent, inside.
Out on the street, they slipped into Whelan's cigarette-smelling Elantra.
There's these shitheads, the Alvarez brothers, in 2015 over there,
pointing to another pre-war across the street, also with a deep H-block entrance.
Out of the blue, they've been buddying him up all this last week like a lost cousin.
Apartment? Billy writing.
Fifth floor is all I know. The youngest brother, Marcus, just got back from upstate. Tomas, I once caught trying to jimmy a storage lock in my building with a gravity knife.
So prints are on file? You could say that. Anybody else? Around here? Shrugging as he reached for the door handle. Start with them. Stepping from the Elantra back out onto the street, Billy wandered to the rear of the car, paused to light a cigarette, then saw the bullet holes in the trunk, moonlight brightening their jagged edges, some curling in, some curling out.
Come here, he said.
Whelan came around, regarded the constellation of punctures, then lit a cigarette himself.
Can you pop it, please?
You kidding me?
Jimmy.
You think there's something in there?
Billy stared at him.
If you want to be a prick about it, get a warrant.
Sweet Pea wasn't even yours.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You did it for Redman?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Then again, before Billy could say anything more, I don't know what you're talking about.
Deaf to the occasional horns and blind to the oncoming headlights, Billy took a brief walk down the center of Fort Washington Avenue, his hands clasped on top of his head. Yasmin was in Florida when Eric Cortez was shot. Pavlicek was at the hospital with his son when Banyan died all over Penn Station. Sweet Pea ended his days in the boot of Whelan's car. He himself was at a crime scene in Manhattan when Curtis Taft was being hogtied in the Bronx. Redman had been telling the truth after all, but only the partial truth. They were all in on it, but no one was anywhere near the scene when their own demons had gone out of the picture. They had swapped whites. 2 hours later, as he and Stupak were escorting Tomas and Marcus Alvarez out of their apartment house for questioning, the uncuffed brothers shouting in each other's face not to say shit, Billy saw that Whelan had made no effort to move his car from in front of the building, their entire convoy having to walk past it,
in order to get to the waiting van. Milton Ramos. The call from Anita came in as he was sitting on the side of his bed, rewrapping the ace bandage on his empurpled thigh, Victor's boot print there still so clearly defined on his flesh that he could have accurately ordered him a pair of shoes.
Milton, your daughter left 3 messages on your phone. Why aren't you calling her back?
I've been drowning in work, he said, reaching for the chartreuse on his night table. Is she okay?
Other than you not calling her, she's fine.
Milton threw back a shot, got up, and began looking for his car keys. Is she mad at me for last night?
She hasn't said anything.
Dropping to the floor, he felt around beneath the bed. I have to apologize for my behavior. I was upset.
It's okay. I just figured with all the terrible stress you have on you right now.
He stopped moving. What do you mean?
That gang contract.
Contract. Crouching there, confused, then remembering his story, rising to his knees, I have to ask you again. Sophia, do you still want her?
Do I want her?
Anita sounded unsure of his meaning.
Sure, she's a delight.
Good. Returning to his search.
Just give me an idea of when you'll be taking her back.
It's almost over, he said, spotting the car keys in one of his tossed-off shoes.
I just don't understand why you don't call her.
He was pretty sure he could drive. The cemetery was one of those unending necropoli that lined the ride into the city from JFK, a crowded mouthful of gray teeth, unkempt and askew. But up close, say, if you found yourself kneeling before a loved one or 2 or 3, it wasn't that bad. And that's where he found himself, in a catcher's squat before the stones of his mother and 2 brothers, desperate to get his bearings. He was no great master planner of revenge, no fiendish calculator. He was nothing more than an increasingly violent and out-of-control wreck whose hands shook all the time now from drinking. Nothing more than a raging borderline wet brain, so constantly tired these days that he could barely get in or out of bed. And assuming they had recovered his bat from the scene, it would only be a matter of days before they matched his prints. In high school, his English teacher didn't think anyone in class could get through Moby Dick without tossing the book out a window, so she had brought in a Betamax tape of the movie, drawn the blinds, and played it on a roll-down screen. Most of the students were bored stupid by the black-and-white film, but not him. He had been riveted by the metal-eyed captain, his blazing doggedness, and in the end, when he went down into the sea strapped to the beast that he had lived to kill, it had struck Milton as the perfect outcome. And that's how it should end between him and Carmen. Sophia was with the right people, and this patch of earth, right here among his brothers and his mother, looked so inviting. He was so tired all the time now. He just had to move fast before he was unable to move at all. Chapter 16. When Billy returned to the funeral home the next morning, Redman and his wife, Nola, were sitting on facing folding chairs across the aisle from each other in the darkened chapel, both staring at the carpet while Rafer flew around the room waving a cosmetic stippling brush in his hand.
It's 10 in the morning, Redman said. I was expecting you at dawn.
Nola stood up and left. Billy waited while Redman got to his feet, took the brush back from his son, then lifted him in his arms.
If I could have, I would have. You better believe that, he finally said. Fact of the matter is, I can carry a 250-pound body across this room from the prep table to the casket. No problem. But if I go more than a block to buy a beer, I need a walker. End of the day, all I could do was disappear him.
Could you put Rafer down, please? Redman gave him a look as if Billy were about to slap on cuffs.
I can't talk about this with the kid in your arms, Billy said. Bending stiffly from the waist, Redmond complied, Rayford taking off for his grandfather's cubicle, where the old man was once again playing poker on his computer.
What do you mean, disappear him? Billy said. Disappear him how?
He left here in a casket, underneath someone else.
Underneath who?
That girl you had me bury.
You did that to her?
I did it to him.
All he needed was an exhumation order, find out if Martha Timberwolf had any company beneath her stone. And when the forensics came back on Whelan's trunk, they were bound to find something. You know what Whelan was up to before he did it?
I got up one morning, went out back for a smoke, and there's Sweet Pea Harris laying in the yard. And that's all I'm saying about it.
Did you ask him to do it?
I said, that's all I'm saying about it.
How about the others?
Which others? I want to know who did who.
Why?
Why?
Redmond opened a box of cheap hand fans advertising the funeral parlor, then began depositing them on chair seats.
I'm just curious, Billy said. Did you embalm him?
Either that or let him stink up the joint.
Jesus Christ, Redmond, where's your heart?
Where's yours? You pursue this, you'll be taking people away from their kids. So where's yours?
He said, walking off before Billy could walk out.
At Maimonides, Victor was asleep in his bed, Richard lying next to him, wide-eyed but withdrawn. On a sofa at the opposite end of the room, Carmen was also asleep, hands curled under her chin, her face pressed so deeply into a cushion that he had to resist moving her head back. Billy stood against a wall, dutifully stared at the three of them until he thought he would go crazy.
Who did who?
Stepping out into the hallway, he called Elvis Perez.
Are you in? For about a half an hour or so. What's up?
Do you still have the tapes from Penn Station?
Of course.
I never took a look at the one under the information boards.
That's because I told you it's a waste of time.
I'm leaving now.
Really? If I thought, I'm leaving now.
Where's Waldo, right? Perez said, standing over Billy's shoulder as they viewed the rescue tape of the scene beneath the LIRR track information board. See what I'm saying?
Billy had to agree. The scrum of plastic derby-wearing revelers was so tight under the board that when he finally was able to ID as Vic, Banyan was already leaving bloody shoe prints on his way to the subway, dead man jogging.
Where's Waldo in hell? Elvis said.
When Perez left with his partner on a witness interview run, Billy remained at his desk and reran the tape. Again, nothing. Just Banyan popping out of the periphery and taking off. There were others coming and going under the board besides Banyan, staggerers, stragglers, latecomers to the party, and those who just wandered away as if having lost interest in getting home. But none of these wanderers, all leaving the crowd at the same time, or just after Banyan made his stumbling dash to nowhere, exhibited any kind of suspect body language, no one running or even walking off at anything more than a dawdling pace, no one even glancing back at the crowd they had just left. Most of the people whose faces were turned to the camera and could be identified had already been interviewed by Midtown South, including all of Banyan's friends that night. Teams of detectives had either traveled out to Long Island or caught the potential witnesses at their workstations in Manhattan, not one of these sit-downs yielding a single helpful lead. Billy reran the tape, then ran it again, this time in slow motion. On his sixth viewing, someone caught his eye. One of the commuters, exiting the throng a moment before, not after Banyan, which made sense given that it must have taken the stupefied Vic a moment or two before he realized what had already happened to him. The figure, its back to the camera as it briefly lingered at the bottom of the frame before leaving the scene altogether, looked like nothing so much as a small, upright bear.
They finally salvaged the tape, Billy said.
What tape?
Yasmin asked from behind her desk in the university security office. From Penn Station.
I thought they had that tape.
The other one.
What other one?
Tired of the dance, Billy showed her the printout of the shaggy form walking away from the crime scene before anyone there knew it was a crime scene. Yasmin looked at it, then, unconsciously, Billy assumed, glanced at her Tibetan coat draped over an empty chair. It was either you or Janis Joplin coming out of that crowd.
Do you know how many coats like this? Don't jerk me around, he said wearily.
Not now, all right? She was a long time in responding.
You have those two little boys, she finally said. Could you imagine me ever coming up to you like this?
I didn't kill anybody, Yasmin.
The hell you didn't. And what did we do? Closed ranks and protected your ass.
It was a justified shoot. I didn't need you to.
Oh, yes, you did, Cokey boy.
One of the other retired detectives working at the school came into the office and dropped a folder on her blotter, Yasmin getting to work on it before he even left. Billy sat there for a while studying the photographs push-pinned into her wall. Campus trespassers, a trash dorm lounge, the facades of problematic East and West Village bars. Yasmin, the story's going to come out one way or another.
Well, one good story deserves another, she said, flicking the side of her nose.
Billy got up to leave.
You know, Dennis, he's a good guy, a good dad. I'll give him that.
Billy stood there waiting for the punchline.
But I could have been with you all these years, you know? I could have been your wife. Dominique and Simone could have been your daughters.
I'll give you a week to get a lawyer, he heard himself say.
You'd do that for me,
she said sweetly. Billy almost positive she was being sarcastic.
So you say, Carmen said, looking down at the Penn Station printout spread out on the kitchen table before her.
So I know, Billy looking at her, and you know too. Carmen shifted her gaze from the table to the window.
Do you remember when I couldn't get out of bed for close to 3 months? What did she do for us?
This has nothing to do with that.
No? What's it have to do with?
Do I even have to answer that? Resting her brow on the heel of her palm, Carmen looked as if she'd rather be anywhere else than in this room with this man right now. Do I even have to answer that? Billy pleaded.
Why did you marry me? She said.
Why did I what?
What did you see in me?
I don't know. I saw you. Where are we going with this? Carmen swept the printouts to the floor.
Jesus, Billy. Her voice clotted with tears. Sometimes people just need to be forgiven.
More cryptic and distance-making shit from his most intimate of intimates, Billy watching her climb the stairs to the bedroom and feeling more isolated on this than ever before. Three bodies, and so far everyone was either defying him, threatening him, or tossing off pronouncements fit for a sphinx. Everyone acting like they had his number. Billy called first Redmond, then Whelan. Got the machine for both and left the same message. 1 week to lawyer up. He started to dial Pavlicek's number, then hung up in mid-dial. This one had to be face-to-face. Not really thinking about what he would see when he walked into the private suite at the Westchester Medical Center in Valhalla, Billy took one look at the patient, then turned and retreated, hoping no one inside had noticed. Out in the hallway, he caught his breath and then re-entered, having no choice but to accept that the sallow-skinned, seemingly inert stick figure lying in the bed, with its distant, unresisting eyes, was, still was, John Jr., only 6 months ago a bear of a young man who'd often had to sidle through doorways. Speechless, he floated across the room and stood in a corner.
You know, I was trying to describe to Johnny here,
Pavlicek said, his eyes never leaving his son's face. what it was like for us back in the 90s. The bust-ass blocks, the gangs, the dope lines going right past the precinct house, that whole rodeo. He was seated on the side of the bed, one hand on the kid's thigh, the other on his forehead, as if he was afraid his son would start to levitate. "John," Billy whispered. "I had no idea. I'll never forget the day I bought my first building on Fail Street. $5,000. The old guy running down the street with the check in his hand. You'll never make a dime. But then the fun began, remember? All those all-nighters, me, you, Whelan, Redman, Charlie Torriano, God rest his soul. Stripping, sanding, uncovering that beautiful wood, the moldings, the sconces. Then that morning light coming in." Billy stepped to the bed and lightly touched Junior's hand, the kid turning his head in response, but too deep in his medicated drift to raise his eyes. "Billy, I swear to you, 26 buildings later and nothing ever felt as good to me as rehabbing that first dump on Fail. Well, what the hell? I made my dent." There was no way Billy could bring up what he had come to say. Not here, and not now. Pavlicek let him get halfway to the door. "Redman told me that you couldn't drop the bomb on him this morning until he put his kid down." Looking at Billy for the first time since he came into the room. "So I can imagine what a bitch this must be for you right now." "That all could wait," he said. "For what, Junior to die? You're gonna make this into a death watch before you turn me in?" "What I meant, I know what you meant." Pavlicek cut him off. "Just let it happen." Billy took a seat on the edge of the narrow visitor's bed wedged under the far window, dress shirts and sweaters spilling out of a Gladstone bag on the blanket. "John, what do I do?" He had always looked up to Pavlicek for guidance, they all did. "It looks like you're doing it. How can you make me carry this?" "In all honesty, you weren't exactly on my mind at the time," Pavlicek said. "Besides, you did it to yourself. No one told you to go fucking investigate." "You shot Cortez? Do you need me to say it?" "I do. I shot Cortez. I screwed it up, but that there was definitely me. I can't sit on three bodies," Billy said. "I can't live with it." "Then don't. Are you serious? Tell me you're not asking for my permission." But he was. He had been asking for permission all along from everyone. From Carmen, from his father, from Redman and Whelan and Yasmin, and having finally received it from Pavlicek, no less, he felt the tension go out of his body like air from a slashed tire. "After Taft in the apartment," Pavlicek said, "you said to me, 'This is how you honor your son?'" "John, in all fairness, you think I don't understand what I did? You think I don't know there's a price to pay? So let me pay it." "All right," Billy said after a while. "All right. Let me be done with it." "All right," Billy said yet again. Then, "I gave the others a week to lawyer up." "A week's fine." John Jr. whispered something indecipherable to Billy's ears, but not to his father's. Pavlicek slipping a straw through the spout of a water bottle, then raising his son's head just enough for him to take a few sips without drowning. Junior then said something else Billy couldn't understand, but that made his father nod in agreement. The room descended into silence, Billy watching Pavlicek alternately minister to his son and just hang at his side, the ticking of an unseen clock underscoring the stillness. "Yasmin's pulling the coke card," Billy finally said. "She said she'd use my history." "She's full of shit," Pavlicek said without looking at him. Billy got up, walked over to the bed, then bent down to kiss John Jr.'s forehead. "I should go." "What the hell?" Pavlicek said. "I made my dent." Milton Ramos. He had always been somewhat indifferent about what he wore to work. Usually it was one of the three sport jackets he had bought from Men's Warehouse the week he'd been promoted to detective. A white or blue dress shirt, pleated chinos or gabardines, and always the black Nike lace-up boots. Good for running if the need arose, and sober-looking enough to pass inspection. But tonight he was going for the suit. Charcoal wool and last worn when he had spoken to Sophia's third-grade class on career day. What a clown show that was. A nice blue-knit tie, and a pink broadcloth button-down from his one trip to Brooks Brothers. But he would no sooner swipe out the Nikes for any other footwear than he would exchange his Glock for a slingshot. Just past midnight, after finally nailing the Windsor knot he'd been striving for, he threaded his holster through his belt, slipped his flask into his ankle holster, dropped a mini bottle of scope into his inside jacket pocket, and left the house. 45 minutes later, he walked into the 15th precinct, headed for the desk, and presented his ID to the duty sergeant. "It's been a while," he said. "Where's the night watch office again?" Chapter 17. Tonight's Hellmouth seemed to be situated in Union Square, three runs to that area in less than 5 hours. The first, at 1 a.m. on Irving Place, involved the discovery of a middle-aged lawyer who had been found nude, bound, and asphyxiated face down in his own bed. The word abuse, with either an R or a D at the end, a mystery for the day tour, carved into his back with a scissor blade. The second run, coming in at 3, was in response to the theft of a 200-pound bluefin tuna worth $7,000 from the kitchen of a sushi restaurant on Park Avenue South. And the third and hopefully last run of the night, coming in at 4:30, was a non-fatal double knifing in the park proper, directly beneath the statue of Gandhi. The actor on that one, a 75-year-old panhandler. The victims, two drunken tourists from Munich who thought it would be a real howl to hand the old piss bum a pre-euro 10-mark German note instead of a few American dollars.
"You should have seen them laughing at me like they was giving a cell phone to a monkey,"
Terrence Burns said over a 5 a.m. Coke in the 6th Squad interview room a few blocks from the scene. Bug-eyed and sporting a steel-colored goatee, he was nearly doubled over with arthritis, but somehow still agile as a cat.
"Like I wasn't gonna know what a motherfucking Deutschmark looks like. Hell, I seen plenty. I had plenty. And I spent plenty when I was over there with the 40th tank back in 61.
"You were there?" Billy, both liking the guy and needing the distraction.
"Didn't I just say that? Had a good time, too, for most of it,"
Burns said.
"The whores used to call us hamburgers, the white boys cheeseburgers. They'd see a bunch of us coming to the club. They'd start throwing out all the shit kickers. No cheeseburger, hamburger only."
"For real?"
"Oh, I'm always for real."
"Another Coke?"
"Fanta, if you got it,"
Burns said.
"Grape or orange?"
Billy went out of the room to hit the vending machine and returned with a Mountain Dew. "So what else was going on back then?" he asked.
"What else? You don't know your history? You don't know about Checkpoint Charlie?"
"I heard of it."
"You don't know nothing about the tank standoff with the Russians? I was a machine gunner. They had me sit up outside the hatch of a M-48, staring right into the cannon of a T-55 for 16 motherfucking hours. Couldn't have been more than 75 yards away. I swear, as scared as I was, if I hadn't been so drunk, we'd have had World War III right then and there."
Returning to the park to pick up a copy of the crime scene unit report, Billy noticed that the small trucks from upstate and New Jersey had begun to arrive for the Union Square Green Market, the vaguely hippie-ish